All right, Crime Talk aficionados, it is Saturday, the 23rd of July. That means one thing, the weekly recap of all the top stories, all conveniently located in one location. Hope you enjoy it, and we'll see you Monday. All right, let's go ahead and open the record for July 18th, 2022. First, it's worse than we thought. There's some new Uvalde body cam footage that comes amid release of the 77-page report by the Texas House of Representatives, which holds states and federal police officers pretty much responsible for the Uvalde shooting massacre. Now, the House probe marked the most exhaustive attempts so far to determine why it took more than an hour for police and other officers to confront and kill that coward Ramos. Now, the report blasted system failures and egregious poor decision-making by nearly all of those in power during the attack, noting how 376 law enforcement officers rushed to the school in a chaotic scene marked by a lack of clear leadership and sufficient urgency. Other than the attacker, the committee did not find any villains in the course of its investigation. The report stated, "Instead, we found systemic failures and egregious poor decision-making. The void of leadership could have contributed to the loss of life as injured victims waited an hour for help, and the attacker continued to sporadically fire his weapon." It is also claimed the 149 United States Border Patrol agents and 91 state police on the scene should have helped with the unfolding chaos. There was an overall lackadaisical approach by law enforcement at the scene, the report read, and for many, that was because they were given and relied upon inaccurate information. For others, they had enough information to know better. The bottom line in the report is what they found is that law enforcement responders failed to adhere to their active shooter training, and they failed to prioritize saving the lives of innocent victims over their own safety. Now, the Uvalde mayor, Don McLaughlin, said in an emailed statement that the city has placed Lieutenant Mariano Pargas, who was acting city police chief on the day of the shooting, on administrative leave. State police officials have sharply criticized the leadership of Arredondo, the police chief of the school district's six-man police force, who state police have said was in control of the scene. But the report noted that hundreds of the officers from agencies that were better trained and better equipped than the school police force badly failed as well. Despite an obvious atmosphere of chaos, the ranking officers and other responding agencies did not approach Arredondo or anyone else perceived to be in command to point out the lack of and need for a command post or to offer that specific assistance, according to the report. These local officials were not the only ones expected to supply the leadership needed during this tragedy. Now, hundreds of responders from numerous law enforcement agencies, many of whom were better trained and better equipped than the school district police, quickly arrived on the scene. Now, in this crisis, no responder seized the initiative to establish an incident command post, the report found, and despite an obvious atmosphere of chaos, the ranking officers and other responding agencies did not approach the Uvalde or anyone else perceived to be in command to point out the lack of and need for a command post or offer that specific assistance. Now, the report also found that the Robb Elementary School failed to adhere to a number of basic safety protocols, which include a lack of keys, leading to teachers regularly leaving the doors unlocked or even propping them open. Door and lock maintenance did not receive adequate attention from the school district, the report noted, pointing out that though the lock in one of the rooms where the shooting took place was known to be unreliable, it was not repaired. In particular, the locking mechanism to room 111 was widely known to be faulty, yet it was not repaired. In this crisis, no responder seized the initiative to establish an incident command post, as they noted in the report, and despite an obvious atmosphere of chaos, the ranking officers and other officers didn't approach anybody to take command. Leading to some of the complacency by the school was that there were 47 lockdown events between May and February, 90% of which concerned Border Patrol activity. And the report revealed that Ramos provided a number of warning signs that he was dangerous, but nobody really did anything to address him. In one of the incidents, Ramos sent someone a message on an Instagram on April 2nd saying, "Are you still going to remember me in 50 something days?" The person responded, "Probably not." Ramos said, "All right, we'll see in May." That's what Ramos replied back. He was also obsessed with gore and violent sex online, posting videos of suicides and beheadings, and harassing women who he played video games with. He was also fired from his job at Whataburger after threatening a female coworker. Gee, hardly any signs at all. Well, despite his violent behavior, no red flags were raised about Ramos, and he was never reported to authorities. At one point, an officer whose daughter was inside the classroom was seen being restrained by fellow officers, preventing him from attempting to rescue his daughter. The video shows how it took officers a full 77 minutes to breach the door to the classroom, where Ramos unloaded more than 100 rounds into his victims. Ramos entered the school at 11:33 and wasn't shot dead until 12:50 p.m. The gunman wasn't stopped until Border Patrol agents entered the building and shot and killed him. Now, the body cam footage captured the moment the Uvalde school police chief repeatedly begged an 18-year-old gunman to put down his weapon after he opened fire in the classroom. The Robb Elementary School police chief, Peter Arredondo, was recorded standing outside the classroom trying to negotiate with Salvador Ramos rather than engage the mass shooter. And he ultimately never responded to the police chief's pleas. Arredondo urged him to talk to him, trying to assure him that this could be end peacefully, and asking him to please put your firearm down. I think it's pretty clear, ladies and gentlemen, I think you all know how I feel about these school shooters. I think they are all cowards, okay? They go to a place that is supposed to be for peaceful, for children, for God's sakes. And they go to these soft targets where they know they're not gonna get shot at. And they go in and kill innocent children who've done nothing to them whatsoever. And the bottom line is, they being the police, just need to go in and take these shooters out as quickly as possible. And guess what? You don't negotiate with terrorists. And that's all this guy is. He was a punk and they waited too long. And I was trying to give the police officer some hope here. Maybe it wasn't that bad, but this report, when you read it, it's worse than you actually thought. 77 minutes, they know what's going on. They know when those gunshots are being fired, the kids are more than likely being killed, and they wait. I mean, I don't know. One person put on leave, that's it. The acting police chief, that's it. But no one's been fired. Something to think about. Let me know what you think should happen. All right, first on the docket, why is the items in the Lori Vallow, Chad DeBale matter not been tested yet for DNA? Well, there's a little thing called consumptive testing. And the prosecution is filing a motion basically saying that they are going to do consumptive testing on several items. What are those items? First, hair on the duct tape inside a body bag reported by the Rexburg Police Department to have been used to transport the remains of J.J. Vallow. And they say that where this is identified in the reports. Ridge detail on the adhesive side of the tape reported by the Rexburg Police Department to be associated with J.J. Vallow's body as described above for trace/touch DNA. Third, a small dark spot on the handles of a shovel and pickaxe reported by the Rexburg Police Department to have been recovered from the garage barn. The state does not intend to consume each of these spots, but to consume a sufficient amount to determine if they contain human DNA and or profile. This evidence is identified in the report, and the swabs reported by the police department to be from Joshua J. Vallow's right hand fingernails and reported been obtained during the autopsy. Now, those are the items that want to be tested. And your first thought is, hey, we have a January trial date, January of 2023 trial date coming up. This case has been going on now for 3 years. Why has it not been tested? Well, if the DNA is going to be consumed in the testing, the prosecution needs to give notice, and most DAs like to get an order from the court saying we're going to do this testing, and it's all going to go away. Of course, the defense objects, and the defense says, hey, you're going to destroy all that. We will not be able to have any for testing, and it could be exculpatory, et cetera, et cetera. Now, how is this problem solved? Well, it's solved rather simply. You go to the court, as the prosecution has done, and the court says, listen, defense, I'm going to order consumptive testing. You can have your expert available at the testing to observe the testing. And if you think there's any errors or flaws, then you can certainly bring that up at trial. But they can be there to observe the cutting, the testing, as well as the analysis. Bottom line, problem solved. The question is, why has it taken this long to get this far in the process? We had the charges filed with the tampering of evidence. Those charges were filed years ago. They could have actually done the testing then. Go forth and do the consumptive testing then, but they waited. So this is an example, ladies and gentlemen, of why, in my humble opinion, if the defense usually has any shot at a win at a trial in a case like this, is you don't delay. You go to trial immediately. If Lori Vallow or Chad Daybell had said, you know what, let's go to trial on that witness tampering case a year ago, there probably wouldn't be sufficient DNA evidence there to do it. Now, would they win? I don't know. It just goes to show you that when the government charges their case, they're telling everybody they're ready to go to trial within the speedy trial limits of that case. And most of the time, they're not. Just something to think about. Let me know. Do you think the prosecution is a little behind the old power curve here? I'm thinking they are. Anyway, we'll talk about it tonight more on our live show. Please join us at 6 p.m. Mountain Time tonight, and we'll talk about this case and much more. Like many Americans, we got a dog during the pandemic. My quarantine dog, Miss Winnie the Bulldog. Now, Miss Winnie has grown accustomed to being around us all the time. When we were leaving the house, Winnie would have extreme anxiety, so we decided to look for natural products to help with her anxiety. We looked for the highest quality CBD treats, and we were not satisfied, and neither was Winnie. So we created a high quality CBD product that absorbs faster and provides the required results faster. Baked in Colorado, CBD treats and beverage enhancers are made with nanotechnology. The nanotechnology makes the CBD extraction more pure, also allows for Baked in Colorado products to work faster. Baked in Colorado products can help reduce your pet's anxiety, ease joint pain, and help with your dog's skin problems. Go to our online store and see what Baked in Colorado product is best for your dog. When you order at bakedincolorado.com, enter code Winnie and receive 15% off your first order. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee. If your dog does not experience the desired results in 30 days, return the product and we will refund your money. No questions asked.
Alec Murdoch. But before we get there, do you remember a guy by the name of Russell Lafitte? That's right. That was Mr. Murdoch's good buddy, friend, and banker. Well, guess what? He was also indicted today on a federal grand jury indictment in Charleston, alleging a longstanding conspiracy between unidentified bank customers, who sources identify as Murdoch, and Lafitte to use the bank as a tool for laundering money that Mr. Murdoch allegedly stole. Now, Mr. Lafitte, he's 51, and he's charged with conspiracy to commit wire fraud and bank fraud. And misapplication of bank's funds. He is looking at up to 30 years in prison. Can you imagine these guys sitting around thinking they own the low country down there in South Carolina and just thinking, they'll never know. They'll never know. We'll get away with it. Well, not for long. Anyway, we'll give them the presumption of innocence, but let's talk about Alex Murdoch. Now, Alex Murdoch arrived at a South Carolina court Wednesday for a hearing over last year's brutal murder of his wife and son, which saw Mr. Murdoch plead not guilty to the double alleged slaying. Now, the hearing also saw Mr. Murdoch denied bond for the alleged crime, with police officers now claiming that they have a mountain of evidence against him, including cell phone and video footage of him talking to his wife moments before she was killed. Now, when asked how he pled to the felony murder charges, Murdoch sported a jail-style buzz cut for the court, and his appearance confidently asserted not guilty. Now, you may notice in the video, Mr. Murdoch in court today, he has slimmed down. Apparently, he is at the detention center, you know, burning a few calories, I guess, or basically not eating. But when you look at all his previous pictures, I would say he's down a good 40 to 50 pounds. Yes, the jail diet can do that for you. Now, when questioned by the prosecutors on how he will be tried, Mr. Murdoch maintained, by God and by country. Now, he requested a speedy trial, and the state agrees to move the case forward as expeditiously as possible. The judge will ponder that along with the motion in regards to a gag order, so neither side can make extrajudicial statements regarding the case and potentially taint that potential jury pool. For those of you who are not familiar with the case, Mr. Murdoch was once a pretty prominent lawyer, and his appearance has changed considerably since he was first arrested and now appears in court for the alleged double homicide of his wife and son. Now, both sides agreed that a bond should not be awarded to Mr. Murdoch due to the fact that he's already in jail on a $7 million bond for some 74 other criminal charges, mostly financially related. Now, Mr. Murdoch was filmed leaving the jail, as you can see here, before being carted back to jail. Now, more than a year after the bodies of Maggie and Paul Murdoch were found at their Hampton Colleton County estate, the hearing, which started about 10 a.m. and lasted less than a half an hour, saw Mr. Murdoch denied bond. And the judge, Judge Clifton Newman, the same judge who previously denied bond for him last October, when the family of his former housekeeper accused him of stealing insurance money after her death. As he left in chains after being arraigned on the indictment. Now, police allege that Mr. Murdoch shot Maggie, his wife, with a rifle and Paul, his son, with a shotgun at their Mosul property back in June of 2021. A motive for the slaying has yet to be determined. Well, at least not disclosed. Now, it's not known how police linked Mr. Murdoch to the deaths after more than a year of investigation, but a law enforcement source with close personal knowledge of the case has told reporters that the police have a multitude of damning evidence against the ex-attorney. Now, the source states that shortly before the hearing, investigators had proved that Mr. Murdoch was at the house when the murder took place due to blood spatter allegedly found on the then lawyer's clothes after the police arrived on the scene. Now, the evidence, if legitimate, contradicts claims that Mr. Murdoch had been visiting his father at a nearby hospital at the time of the murder, only to return and find the bodies. Now, Mr. Murdoch's cell phone, watch, and vehicle GPS allegedly contradict those claims as well. People oftentimes forget, I mean, we've mentioned this before, the phone. If you're going to commit a crime, and I'm not encouraging anyone to do so, but you don't take your phone. You don't take anything electronic. And that includes your car. Most new cars have GPS in them, and you would be amazed at the amount of information that can come from that. And apparently it can tell you, well, where you were and where you weren't in Mr. Murdoch's case. Now, sources added that investigators are adamant that Murdoch lured his wife to the scene under the guise that he wanted her to accompany him to visit his ailing father, with whom she was quite close. Now, the source also alleges that the couple, who had been influential figures in the South Carolina legal scene, had hit a rough patch in their marriage prior to the killings, and that Maggie, at the time of the slaying, was actually staying at the family's beach house on Edisto Island, roughly an hour from the family's estate. Now, it is also alleged that Maggie first declined the request from Murdoch to meet at the family home, suggesting instead that they meet at the hospital. And after some convincing, however, she consented to meet at the home, saying that she would follow Alex to the hospital in her car. That's right. You always have to remember what the other person on the other phone has in their text messages as well. Now, on her way to the home, it's alleged that Maggie messaged a friend to tell her she felt uneasy about the arrangement and that she was worried that Murdoch was up to something. The text reportedly say that Maggie theorized that something about her husband's behavior felt fishy, with one of the messages flat out declaring he's up to something. The identity of the recipient of those texts has not yet been identified, so take it for what it's worth. Now, the alleged most damning piece of evidence is the investigator's possession of cell phone audio and video that the source said placed Murdoch at the crime scene moments before the alleged murder of Maggie took place. Now, as you may recall, Mr. Murdoch alleged that he was struggling with a debilitating opioid addiction, whereupon he went to a treatment right after his friend allegedly tried to make it look like a murder so that he could collect some insurance money for his son. It has taken the police nearly 13 months to bring charges against Mr. Murdoch, who's, as we stated, already behind bars for the alleged embezzlement, as well as attempting to stage his own murder as far as a $10 million insurance scam. Now, months after his wife and son were murdered, Murdoch tried to stage his death so that Buster, his 26-year-old surviving son, could reap the sum, but was criminally charged when the suicide for hire plot fell apart and the attempt failed and the hired hitman was arrested. Now, that incident transpired on September 4th, where Murdoch apparently shot three times by 61-year-old Curtis Smith, one of the former Legal Eagle's many clients. However, according to police, he only suffered superficial gunshot wounds to the head. Now, Smith has since been charged with assisted suicide, aggravated assault, and battery related to the shooting, and he is awaiting trial on those charges. Now, meanwhile, Mr. Murdoch was charged with a conspiracy to commit insurance fraud and jailed following month. His trial is also pending. Now, Murdoch, whose father, grandfather, and great-grandfather were also top prosecutors in South Carolina for nearly a century, believed ending his life was his only option, and his lawyer said at the time, citing his spiraling opioid addiction, which they said evaporated the Mr. Murdoch's net worth over the course of the last 20 years. Jumping back to the murder of Paul and Maggie, Mr. Murdoch originally told police he found the bodies of his youngest son and wife outside a series of dog kennels on the family's 1,700 square feet hunting estate about 10 p.m. on June 7th, 2021. In audio from the 911 call that he placed at 10:07 p.m. that night, Murdoch can be heard telling the dispatcher in a high-pitched speech, "I need the police and I need an ambulance immediately. My wife and child were just shot badly." Now, Paul, who was only 22 at the time, was shot twice with a shotgun, once in the head and once in the chest. Maggie had been shot multiple times with an assault rifle, and their gunshot wounds were believed to be consistent with an execution-style killing, according to police reports. Now, according to many, Paul's body was found partially inside one of the kennels, while his mother's was several feet away, leading investigators to believe that she ran from her killer before being gunned down. Now, at least two of the gunshot wounds were believed to have been inflicted while she was on the ground. In the immediate aftermath of the discoveries, the Murdoch family and attorneys vehemently defended Mr. Murdoch, who they asserted had an ironclad alibi and that his marriage was full of nothing but love. However, Mr. Murdoch's alibi was far from airtight and has changed significantly since his initial claims that he was nowhere near the property between 9 and 9:30 p.m., the time the coroner gave the approximation for the time of death. Now, in the immediate aftermath of the crime, Murdoch told investigators that he was visiting his dying father and his mother roughly 11 miles away at their home in Varnville at the time of the murders. Now, 2 weeks later, Murdoch's brother, John Marvin, and Randy Murdoch told Good Morning America that he had, in fact, dropped his father at a hospital in Savannah before going to visit his mother, who has dementia. Now, according to an account given by Murdoch's lawyer, Jim Griffin, to the state newspaper, Mr. Murdoch claims to have left the property around 9 p.m. to make the 20-minute drive to his mother's house and returned to Mosul, originally claimed at about 10 p.m. It is an account that places him squarely on the scene within the time frame of the alleged killings. Now, it's also been speculated that audio and video data gleaned from Paul's cell phone found by his body, but only recently unlocked by law enforcement, is what prompted Murdoch's dramatic change of tune. It's been reported that not only does this audio and video data show Murdoch speaking with Maggie, but that high-velocity impact spatter of blood found on his clothing that night places him at the scene of the murder when at least one of the victims was killed. Now, the marriage, as I said, was described as full of love, according to multiple sources, was anything but that. One source familiar with the household has stated that Maggie and Murdoch's marriage was a union in crisis. Rumors that Murdoch was having an affair with a fellow attorney have been widely circulated both locally and online. And according to the source who spoke with the newspapers, there was no love lost between the once loving couple. In fact, it's been reported that months before her death, Maggie and Murdoch had argued heatedly over finances. Now, Maggie was apparently quite the stalwart of the South Carolina charity scene, had been socially embarrassed when a check written by her at a charity luncheon bounced. Can you imagine the embarrassment? Well, it is one of the incidents that saw her not only asking questions about family finances, but demanding answers as well. Now, also reported that Maggie was living separately from the Murdochs at their home in Edisto Beach, and that she had only gone to Mosul on the night of her death reluctantly at Murdoch's request. Maggie has also reported to have had gone to see a divorce lawyer in the weeks before the murder, sparking speculation that she was threatening to call in a forensic accountant. At the same time, Murdoch was under extreme pressure to cough up his financial records as part of the wrongful death lawsuit being brought against him and his older son, Richard Buster Murdoch Jr., by the family of Mallory Beach, the teenager killed in the boat crash back in 2019, where it was alleged that Paul was drunk and at the wheel of the boat when it slammed into the pilings on Archer's Creek with six teens all underage, all heavily intoxicated. Now, Mallory Beach, who was 19 at the time, was thrown from the vessel and her body found by two fishermen 1 week later, 5 miles from the crash site. Her cause of death was blunt force trauma and drowning. Now, the Beach family lawyers had repeatedly pressed Murdoch for financial disclosures and set a court deadline of June 9th, just 2 days after Maggie and Paul's murder, for him to hand over all relevant paperwork. Only Murdoch knew that he was in neck deep in debt and what prosecutors alleged was a multi-million-dollar insurance fraud scheme and alleged criminal enterprise. Now, in the months following, investigators looking into Maggie and Paul's death uncovered a litany of crime and insurance fraud that have seen them reopen two suspicious deaths linked to the family. Former housekeeper Gloria Satterfield, who fell after a trip and fall or slip and fall at the Mosul property in 2018, and a local teen by the name of Stephen Smith. Satterfield's son said they were defrauded out of a $4.3 million wrongful death suit brought against Murdoch on his own advice and with the promise that he would take care of them. Instead, it appears as though Mr. Murdoch siphoned off those funds for himself, allegedly with the help of Corey Fleming, a former University of South Carolina roommate and fellow attorney who recommended the Satterfield's brother's use. Fleming has also been charged for his part in that scheme. Now, the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, also known as SLED, recently announced that it had received permission from Satterfield's family to have her body exhumed. And the Hampton County coroner, Angie Topper, asked investigators to look at Satterfield's death again due to inconsistencies. These include the facts that her office was never informed, meaning no autopsy was conducted, and that the manner of death given on the death certificate was listed as natural, and that was not consistent with a trip and fall. Now, the manner of Smith's death is also, again, the subject of investigation. The 19-year-old's body was found on a road in Hampton County in July of 2015 with a head wound so devastating that investigators first thought he had been shot. Police reports revealed that the incident was, in fact, initially investigated as a homicide, but recategorized as a hit and run in the face of strong opposition from the lead investigator, who was one of the first officers on the scene and found no evidence of any vehicular involvement. Now, in addition to this, 15 state grand jury indictments containing 79 charges have come down against Mr. Murdoch, with prosecutors claiming he defrauded a staggering $8.4 million from victims. The truly dire state of his financial affairs may go some way to explaining one of the most bizarre twists in this entire saga: Mr. Murdoch's failed suicide-for-hire plot just 3 months after Maggie and Paul's death, and one day after he resigned from the family Hampton-based law firm. Now, the firm, formerly known as Parker Murdoch, Parker Ellsroth and Dietrich, or PMPED, stripped the Murdoch name from their masthead in January and has since rebranded as the Parker Law Group. The firm later claimed that Murdoch misappropriated company funds, and at least one Murdoch's former colleague is among many bringing suits against him. As we mentioned, and we brought you, I think, one of the first stories too, when the boating accident took place, is that something seemed off. Something seemed as though there was, well, a cover-up, so to speak. And little did we know that this was all going to come to a head now with the financial crimes, the attempted suicide, the drug dealing charges, and now two counts of first degree murder, where Mr. Alec Murdoch, through his attorneys, are demanding a speedy trial within 60 to 90 days of today's date, assuming the court can accommodate that, apparently under the rules of South Carolina. This could get interesting. We've talked about this before. The best bet to win in a case such of this nature is to go on the first setting and see if the prosecution is really, in fact, ready. The prosecution said that they'll accommodate anything that the court desires, but they said that the discovery is quite voluminous today in court, and let's let the defense take a look at that before we get too carried away with a speedy trial, so to speak. So we'll see how this is all going to turn out, but it is going to get interesting. You know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like if you do. Hit that bell for notifications. All right, let's go ahead and open the docket for Thursday, July 21st. First on the docket, Barry Morphew. Remember that guy? Oh, yeah, he was the one charged here in the state of Colorado up in Salida for allegedly murdering his wife, Suzanne Morphew. And then the prosecution completely screwed up the case, took it forward to court with a 132-page affidavit, which was a huge red flag for any attorney. And needless to say, the prosecution had their case gutted by the judge for noncompliance with discovery issues. Well, he also had another case going on. During the course of the investigation regarding the disappearance of Suzanne Morphew, well, the police noticed that Suzanne Morphew voted after she went missing. Well, it turns out that Barry Morphew went ahead and witnessed the ballot, didn't sign the signature, but basically was charged with forgery in regards to that ballot fraud. He basically said, hey, he knew all the other guys were cheating. I knew Suzanne would want to vote for Trump, so I wanted to make sure and hope that they would win. Well, it didn't turn out so well. Had him dead to rights. You'd think if the prosecution really wanted a conviction for Barry Morphew, this would have been it. But no, the prosecution offered him a deferred judgment. So what does a deferred judgment mean? It means that he pled guilty, and it means that he is put on probation. And during the pendency of that probation, the judgment of conviction does not enter. However, if he messes up on probation, he fails to do his 32 hours of useful public service that was assigned to him, or picks up any new cases, then he would go back into court and there would be a petition to revoke that deferred judgment. And if it was based upon technical violations, like he didn't show up to his probation officer, then that conviction could be revoked based upon a preponderance of the evidence. If it was an allegation of a new charge, the prosecution would have to prove it beyond a reasonable doubt. Normally that just trails the new case to see what happens. And if he's convicted, judgment of conviction enters. The court could then sentence him to whatever sentence they deem appropriate. On a class 5 felony, it would be anywhere from probation to community corrections to prison. It would usually depend upon what the new offense was.
bottom line is he cannot possess firearms, can't go hunting for the period of the 1 year deferred judgment. And if he successfully completes it, he's allowed to withdraw his guilty plea. It goes away like it never happened. And he can have his case sealed. Pretty good deal for Barry Morphew. All right. One question I do have, though, for the district attorneys up there. As you may recall, when they dismissed the case, they said they were going to continue to search for Suzanne Morphew, and they knew exactly where she was. They just needed to wait for the snow to melt. Well, it's now July 21st. That mountain snow has melted. I wonder when the police and the district attorney are going to update us on the status of the search for Suzanne Morphew. First, Dylan Rounds. It's been 2 months since Dylan Rounds disappeared from a remote farm near the Utah-Nevada border, but his mother says progress is being made in the investigation. Now, Rounds had been farming in the desert town of Lucene, Utah, and his grandmother spoke with him on May 28th, and nobody has heard from him since. There's been no signs around anywhere and no activity on his cell phone or bank accounts, according to his parents. Local law enforcement is the lead enforcement agency with the FBI assisting, but thus far there have been no big breaks in the case. Now, quote, everybody thinks it's become this big stall, but there's a reason for that, said Candace Cooley, Round's mother. We're not out there searching and we're not having search parties, but there is stuff happening behind the scenes that can't be released to the public right now. As you may recall, at least two men believed to have interacted with Rounds in the days before he vanished have recently been arrested for felony gun crimes in Utah, but have not been charged in the connection with the disappearance of Dylan Rounds. Now, Chase Venstra and James Brenner are in custody, and Ms. Cooley believes they know what happened to her son. She says Brenner sometimes helped Rounds on his farm and was squatting on a nearby property. As for Venstra, she had never heard of him until her son went missing. Ms. Cooley goes on to say that Brenner has been listed as an official suspect, and on the affidavit that was served to get the warrant, they listed it as a homicide investigation. That's according to Ms. Cooley. Now, learning police are considering Rounds' disappearance was a homicide was somewhat of a relief to Ms. Cooley, she says, because now investigators have a specific focus. Cooley is trying to remain positive. Dylan Rounds' 20th birthday is coming up on August 1st. I guess we'll give Ms. Cooley the benefit of the doubt here. However, it would seem as though if it's a missing person slash homicide case, well, to prove any homicide case, it's a heck of a lot easier if you have the body. These two guys that are in custody seem like pretty cool characters. And I don't mean like cool you want to hang out with. I mean like they've been through this before and they're going to keep their mouth shut. And so they go do a little time on some gun cases and that's it. I don't know. I think I'd still be looking, but that's just me. Let me know what you think in the comments.